This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Bill Kegel from Millikan University, where he teaches history and religion. And we're talking about the myth of U.S. Christian foundations. Many people in recent years have talked about America being founded on Christian principles, being actually a Christian nation. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to be referring to a book that's just out last year, 2006, by the managing editor of Newsweek, John Meacham, M-E-A-C-H-A-M, called American Gospel, God and the Founding Fathers and the Making of a Nation. And Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be back. Are we going to make this a habit?
I'd like to start by talking about one of the in the appendix to this book. Meacham has several fascinating early documents on religion in America, and one that was totally new to me was a peace treaty between the United States and the ruler and subjects of Tripoli in Barbary. And let me just read this. This came, it started when George Washington was president, and a man was selected to go and negotiate this treaty in 1796, and finally in 1797, which actually was when John Adams was president then, this was adopted. Here's what it says: as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion.
That is correct. This was during the Barbary Wars. Once we gained our independence from Great Britain, we lost the protection of the British Navy. And Muslim pirates along the North African coast had a heyday, capturing American ships, holding the crews for ransom, making money off the cargoes. So our first war, undeclared war, incidentally, was against the Muslims in North Africa. Thomas Jefferson sent the Navy and the Marines to take care of these Barbary pirates, and since this was a Muslim area, the treaty was with the Muslims along the Barbary coast, the north coast of Africa, along the Mediterranean. And yes, it states very specifically this is not a Christian nation.
It says, going on, just to read a little bit more, as the United States has itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, and as the said states, the United States, never have entered into any war or act of hostility against Mohammedan or Muslim nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries, Tripoli and the early United States.
That's right. Our founding fathers saw religion as a very divisive issue, and that's why we have separation of church and state. Although the right wing argues that the separation of church and state, the idea comes from the 20th century and the Supreme Court. It goes back to the founding fathers. And John Meacham makes a very good case of this. He does omit some things that would have strengthened his case. For example, the Jewish community in New York were supporters of the American Revolution from the word go. They did everything they could to support George Washington and his troops when they were in New York trying to keep the British from taking the city. They supported the revolution throughout. And once George Washington was elected as our first president under the Constitution, he journeyed to New York, where the temporary capital of the country was. And between his arrival in New York and his actual inauguration as first president, he met with leaders of the Jewish community in New York, and he said very specifically, the United States is not founded as a Christian nation. This is a nation where all religions can worship in freedom. So we have good, positive evidence that our founding fathers wanted to avoid identifying the United States with any one single religion. The right wing is arguing that our founders were Christians. Well, John Adams was a Unitarian. He flatly rejected the established church in New England and his home state of Massachusetts. He was appalled at their religiosity. So he was a Unitarian, as were several other founding fathers. Many of our founding fathers were deists who believed that God had created the world and wound it up like a giant clock, which was the high technology of the day. But God let things run on its own. So among the deists, Thomas Jefferson, of course, Benjamin Franklin, and there's pretty good evidence that Washington himself was a deist. Martha Washington, his wife, was a devout Christian who read her Bible daily, and he made a gallant effort to accompany her to church on Sundays at the local Anglican church. But when the clergy got on him for not taking communion, Washington just dropped out of church altogether.
Jefferson is a particularly interesting character, and his religious ideas are hard to figure out. Meacham talks about this in his book some. Talk a little bit more about Jefferson.
Well, he's credited with the phrase about a wall of separation between church and state. Actually, that phrase goes back to Roger Williams, who was driven out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and bought land from the Indians and established Rhode Island. So it was Roger Williams who first proposed that there had to be a wall of separation between the church and the state if there were going to be any kind of religious freedom. Jefferson picked up on that idea. As I said, he was a deist. He believed that God did not interfere in human affairs at all. Jefferson was an Enlightenment thinker. He believed that there was a God, a providential God, and this is obvious from all of his writings. But he firmly believed that for the good of the church and of the state, that the two had to be separated into two separate realms. However, he did not believe that you could remove God from the nation. He believed that without a belief in God, there would be no such thing as morality, which is an issue we can go into if you would like. He just did not care for organized religion. He found no sense whatever in Christian beliefs. He did study the Gospels, and Jefferson actually went through the Gospels and cut out everything that he thought was inappropriate, including all references to the deity of Christ, and published his own version of the Gospels, removing specific Christian teachings.
And things that were contrary to the scientific understanding of his day.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let me let listeners know that you can join this conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, make a phone call to 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. This is a live call-in show on Sunday nights at WILL. And if it's a long-distance call, do use the 800 number, including if you're listening via your computer on the Internet. That's a toll-free number that's will get you into the station to join our guest, Bill Kegel from Millikan University, as we talk about the early founding of the United States in terms of its religious commitments or attitudes. I see we have a call coming in on our toll-free line. I'll get to that in just a moment. Let me just ask Bill a little bit about, give your background a bit so people know what perspective you're bringing to this.
Okay, yes. I'm an ordained Presbyterian minister. I have 2 degrees in religion. I have clinical training in counseling and was a professional counselor for all the years that I was a pastor. I also have 2 degrees in history from the University of Illinois, including history. I teach American history, world history, and religions.
We are now ready to take a call. Number four, line number four. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, a very appropriate time for a conversation like this. You referred to the founding four persons, founders, Franklin, Jefferson, others. I realize generalizations sometimes are hard to make, but would it be accurate to say that the vast majority of persons who of the founding individuals, such as those who penned the Constitutional Convention and signed the Declaration of Independence, had some kind of framework that would be similar to deist and were not of an orthodox Christian persuasion?
I think that's true of the majority of them. And I think it was true of the majority of Americans at the time. According to the best statistics, at the time of our independence, only about 5% of the American population were members of churches. 5%.
About 1780, 1790?
Yes. It was much higher in Massachusetts, New England, but even in Massachusetts, only 25% of the population were church members in 1776.
Was Massachusetts the highest percentage of
By far, yes.
I see. It always fascinates me the way that someone such as James Kennedy, who every once in a while, just for entertainment, I'll watch, is able to weave into his mythology the orthodoxy of the founding persons. But it just seems to be, as you just indicated, so contrary to what so many scholars have seemed to be able to unearth. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your call.
Bill, lay out for us, some of us whose knowledge or memories may be somewhat spotty, the difference between, say, Virginia and Massachusetts in terms of the first folks to arrive from Europe and what was motivating them.
Virginia was colonized, founded as a profit-making business. The investors in England sent this expedition. They hoped to find silver and gold. They hoped to bring back wealth. They hoped to trade with the Indians and develop a real commerce relationship that would produce profit. So there's no doubt that the Virginia colony was founded to make profit, and that was true throughout its early history. The founding fathers of Massachusetts came so that they could worship their own way. So this is where the myth came from that America was founded by Christians who came here to establish religious freedom. Well, the Puritans came to worship their own way without interference of the official Anglican Church. However, Massachusetts ended up with an established church, the Congregational Church, and Virginia had an established church, the Church of England. So both of them had real struggles to separate church from state during the move for independence and the writing of the Constitution.
And in Meacham's book, The American Gospel, that we're using sort of for a platform this afternoon, he points out that the difference between Plymouth and Jamestown also resulted in sort of problems further on. That Virginia eventually did have an act passed that Jefferson wrote of establishing religious freedom, but it was hard fought.
Yes, it was. But back to the point I was making before, if you look at American history, a very tiny minority of immigrants to this country, and after all, we are a nation of immigrants, which makes the current fight about immigration interesting too. Why is a nation of immigrants so anti-immigrant? But the vast majority of them came for economic reasons. They came for opportunities that they did not have in their homeland. Only a tiny minority came for religious reasons. And for some reason, we focus on that tiny minority and their religion. But it gives a distorted view of the actual reasons for immigration to this country.
Fairly early on, the majority of folks, although they may not have been church members, were trying to impose their will, their Protestant Christianity on some of the minorities. And it was Catholics, it was Jews, it was agnostics, atheists, deists. How did that majority get so strong so fast?
I'm not sure. But if we go back in American history 100 years to, 1900, 1890s, I think the vast majority of American Christians would have said this is a Christian nation. And in fact, in 1893, the Supreme Court ruled that this is officially a Christian nation. But if you look at our history, the genocide we committed against the Native Americans after they refused to convert to Christianity, the way we treated immigrants after the Irish started coming in, and they weren't Protestants, they were Catholics, they were Papists. If you look at this whole issue of slavery and the segregation that followed slavery, if you look at the treatment of women, if you look at the way we exploited working class people for much of our history. I'm really amazed that people would say this is a Christian nation. We certainly haven't behaved as a Christian nation. And yet, as I said, back around the turn of the century, the 20th century, I'm sure the vast majority of Americans would have said this is a Christian nation. They just believed that. And Christian conservatives still believe that.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. You know, something that no one seems to point out at all is the way the First Amendment reads. And it says that Congress shall may enact no law establishing religion. It doesn't say establishing this religion or that religion or even a religion. It says that shall make no law establishing religion. And yet no one points that out anymore. Would you comment on that, please? Take the answer off the air.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your call. Most of the founding fathers were very, very familiar with the religious wars that had taken place in Europe between Protestants and Catholics. They realized how much violence and unrest and bloodshed and conflict there was when nations tried to establish one religion. They looked at the experience of France, where Louis XIV decided that the only way to create a unified modern nation was to force everybody to accept one religion. And he drove out everyone who was not Catholic. The founding fathers saw religion as, number one, a cause of conflict if it becomes an established religion, and yet they felt that belief in God was an important principle politically, morally, socially. So they encouraged belief in God. They discouraged the establishment of any one religious view at the expense of others. And that's what George Washington told the Jewish community. This is not a Christian nation. This is a nation for people of all faiths to worship freely. If you combine church and state, you threaten both the state with a theocracy, but it's even a worse threat to religious freedom. If one religion becomes the official religion, then it becomes, unfortunately, historically at least, a means of oppression. And that's what the founding fathers were so afraid of. They did not want religion to become a divisive issue.
In some of the state constitutions, there was the establishment of Christianity, and in some cases there were requirements that people swear allegiance to Christian beliefs before they could even be seated in state legislatures. Meacham talks about North Carolina at one point electing a Jewish state representative who was not allowed to be seated at first because he would not subscribe to that, would not take that oath. Eventually, those were removed from state constitutions, but again, that took quite a bit of time.
Yes, it did, and it has resurfaced in the last election. A gentleman was elected from the state of Minnesota to the House of Representatives. He is a devout Muslim. He took his oath of office holding a Quran. He refused to use a Bible. And incidentally, the Quran he used was from the Library of Congress. It was one that belonged personally to Thomas Jefferson. So here's a devout Muslim taking his oath of office on a Quran that belonged to Thomas Jefferson and many, many people in the House, in politics, and in our nation as a whole were extremely upset that he would not take the oath of office on a Bible. But this is what the founding fathers intended.
What about the use of the Bible in taking the presidential oath, for example, the use of God Save the Court in American courts? Why do those persist?
Because our founding fathers thought it was important, and most politicians ever since have felt that a belief in God is important. A belief in God, not a specific God, not a specific belief, but they thought it was important for people to have a faith in some kind of deity. I think our founding fathers believed that without that, there would be no grounds for morality. If we're not accountable to a higher being, why should we act morally?
But some of the founders seemingly thought that you could get that from reason, and that there were good reasons for accepting a morality based on logic, history, human experience. And yet they would go along with at least the trappings of theism or deism. I feel the need to defend the right of atheists to be offended at that.
But politicians have always seen that belief, generalized belief in God, as a way to unify the people. And atheists in our country have been extremely unpopular. Incidentally, I'm scheduled to have a debate next week, next Sunday, with an atheist. Should be a very interesting conversation, I hope.
Where is that?
At First Presbyterian Church in Decatur.
What's the debate about?
It's a debate between an atheist and me.
What's the topic?
I'm not sure. It's wide open. I agreed to do this only on...
So it's more of a discussion rather than a debate about a particular issue?
I have no idea what I'm getting into.
Okay.
It's wide open. Uh-huh. I just, when I was asked to do this, I said only on the understanding that I have no interest in trying to win an argument, but rather debating the issues. But even very recent polls have shown that probably 90% of Americans would never vote for an avowed atheist.
Interesting.
Huh. So are atheists really free in our country? Well, they're beginning to fight back. There's an amazing number of books being published right now by atheists.
On the evils of religion, sure.
Yes.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Bill Kegel, who teaches history and religion at Millikan University in Decatur. Bill has his doctorate in history from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. What was your dissertation on?
Russian-American relations.
We're discussing, among other things, John Meacham's book in 2006 called American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. We're talking about partially the popular myth in some circles, particularly among conservative Christians, that American was founded as a Christian nation. And we're talking about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and other documents from those early days.
I'd like to, if I may, sure, indicate just how complex this is. One of the Enlightenment thinkers who heavily influenced our founding fathers was John Locke, a Scots philosopher. Locke wrote in 1690 to justify the revolution that had taken place in Britain, called the Glorious Revolution because it was remarkably bloodless. But in a day when everybody believed in the divine right of kings, Locke felt he had to justify the fact that the English people had overthrown their king, driven the royal family into exile, and invited in a new king. Now, if you believe in the divine right of kings, that's a rebellion against God as well as against the king. So Locke wrote a very interesting treatise on civil government. He also wrote in the same year, 1690, an essay on human understanding, which is very important for our founding, too. In his essay on human understanding, which is the founding of modern psychology, I think, he argued against the idea of it's your blood that makes you superior or inferior. The blue bloods, the royalty, were born inherently superior to common people who had common blood in their veins. Locke threw all of that out. He said, all of us, every human being is born with a tabula rasa, a blank slate. The person we become is written on that blank slate by our experience, our education, our parenting. But we all start off on an equal basis with a blank slate. And Locke's idea was written into our form of government. All men are created equal. That's directly from John Locke. His idea of representative government is written into our founding documents. Now, Locke was an Enlightenment thinker, and yet he was also a profoundly religious Protestant. He also wrote a book on the rationality of Christianity. Now, Locke was affected by the Protestant Reformation in Geneva under John Calvin. And this is where this really gets complicated. The Protestant Reformation, first in Germany and then in Switzerland, wanted to reform the church. They had no intention of founding a separate church, but that's what ended up happening. In reforming the church, they also wanted to reform church government, because the church, once it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, simply adopted the hierarchical form of government of the Roman Empire. The form of government, the structure, power structure of the Roman Catholic Church is an exact copy of the Roman government structure. The Protestant reformers, especially in Switzerland, had seen so much abuse of power and authority on the part of the church and the state that they wanted to come up with a new form of government. And it was the Protestant reformers in Geneva who came up with the idea of electing people to run the church and electing other people to run the government. They separated church and state, but both church and state were governed by elected representatives. This idea about church government and freedom and power coming from the people rather than coming down from the top, from God, was adopted by a young Scotsman, John Knox, who went back and started the Protestant Reformation in Scotland. John Locke was directly in line with Protestant thinking. So what I'm saying is, if you go back far enough, you can argue that the principles on which America was founded come out of the Protestant Reformation. Therefore, you can argue that our country was founded on Christian principles. Am I making sense?
Well, we'll see. We have a caller here with a comment on line number one. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I think your comments were more important than mine, but my question, I just tuned in late, and my question was, do you think mankind has become more humane or less humane? We've had a lot of time to be humane. What's your answer to that?
I don't think human nature has changed in the last several thousand years. I think any one of us is capable of evil, and any one of us is capable of cruelty. American troops have committed atrocities, documented atrocities, in every war we've fought. War dehumanizes individuals, and they do inhuman things, and that is inevitable.
Yes.
Any one of us is capable of the worst evil. And this, again, is a point where I disagree with the religious right. The religious right insists that there are good people and there are evil people, and you can tell the difference. George Bush, you know, if you're either with us or you're against us, it's either or. Ronald Reagan's evil empire. Well, every empire does evil, including the American empire. I think the truth is that all of us are good, are capable of good, and all of us are capable of evil. And if you want to draw the line between good and evil, it has to go down through the center of each of us as a person, because evil is a possibility for each one of us. Civilization seems to be a very thin veneer, and sometimes even our religious morality seems to be a rather thin veneer when we are in times of real stress and danger, like combat, for instance. Any one of us can become inhuman.
Yeah.
So I think the only thing that's changed is that we now have weapons that are much more efficient at killing larger numbers of people.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad for your comments and your perspective.
Well, thank you. I hope that doesn't sound too pessimistic.
No.
I think we need to be realistic about evil, and realistic to me means every one of us, including me, is capable of evil.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let me give the phone numbers again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We'll reach the studio, and Technical Director Matt Kessler will take your call and get you into our conversation very quickly. Elsewhere, the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, and that's including people who are listening on the internet. Our website is WILL.UIUC.com. AM580.edu, and you can click on AM580 and hear the programs being broadcast at this time. These programs are also archived there, so if you have missed part of this program or any other program you'd like to check out in Keeping the Faith, do go there and see what's available, and you may listen via your computer. This is WLL AM 580, a radio service of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supported by our listeners, of course, and made possible by the College of Communications. Our guest is Bill Kegel. We're talking about the myth of U.S. Christian foundations. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Next week, I'll be talking here on Keeping the Faith with Father Greg Ketchum from the Newman Foundation, and he's chaplain at the St. John's Catholic Church on campus. We'll be talking with Father Ketchum and one or two others from Newman about some of their plans and the campus ministry there. They have a huge building project going on that should be fascinating to hear about. In the next couple weeks in June, some of our themes will be compassionate listening and Final Exit. Some of you remember the Hemlock Society. Final Exit is our people who are concerned about end-of-life issues and whether people have the right to decide when they die. And incidentally, I need to ask our listeners, I have misplaced the contact information for people who will be talking on June 24th about Final Exit. So if some of the listeners would call the station, please, and talk to our engineer, I need contact information for the people who will be the guests on June 24th, talking about the Final Exit. And again, the number here, you can just use the same number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and talk to our technical director, Matt Kessler, and leave that information for me, please. Thank you. Let's get back to our topic for today. Bill Kegel, tell us a little bit about Jews in this country early on. I notice in John Meacham's book, he quotes from the letter that George Washington wrote in August of 1790. He was about 18 months into his presidency, and he wrote to the Hebrew congregation in Rhode Island, and he had this sentence: "May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness on our paths, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy." It seems like an amazingly progressive attitude that Washington expressed in that in 1790.
Yes, it is. Actually, the first Jews appeared on our shores when New York was still New Amsterdam and ruled by the Dutch. And the Dutch governor of New Amsterdam did not welcome those Jews, to put it mildly. He considered them usurers, which meant they were money lenders, bankers. And they made a habit of cheating on Protestants, or Christians, as they were called.
Or at least were accused of that.
Right. Well, there was grounds for this. Christian, quote-unquote, nations in Europe forbid the Jews to own any land. A Jew could not own a land anywhere in Europe. They had to resort to other ways to make a living, and they became the bankers and the doctors and the lawyers and the professional people. They were forced into this by the laws of Christian nations that cut off all, you know, ordinary occupations to them. They had to do something to survive. But anti-Semitic feelings have been very strong in this country. We really didn't overcome a lot of it until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s. This anti-Semitism was just built into our society. And I think we've made a lot of progress, but there's still anti-Semitism. There was a revival of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, during the 1920s and 1930s, and they targeted Catholics and Jews more than they did blacks. They saw Catholics and Jews as more of a threat to America than blacks. So, yes, George Washington was very much enlightened for his own day, and he would have been enlightened even in the 1960s, ahead of most of us.
The quotation that that Washington ended that letter with was from the book of Micah, and John Meacham comments on it and points out that in that extended passage in Micah, there's a call for the house of the Lord to be established on the top of the mountains, and many nations will come, and God will teach us God's ways. And this is the passage that also has the God shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. I had never noticed that before, Meacham's highlighting the fact that it was strong nations that God rebuked. And when it comes to finding a way to peace, it's those with power that are most dangerous. I suppose it's obvious, but interesting here in the early Hebrew prophets, we have that insight.
Yes. There is a definite bias throughout Scripture, a bias in favor of the poor and the powerless, and a bias against the rich and the powerful. And we tend to ignore that because it doesn't fit with our American ideals very well. We want to achieve power.
And interestingly now, when America is seen as the one superpower, most powerful nation on earth in terms of its armaments, much talk about American empire, what kind of dangers there are to that?
I think the biggest danger is what it does to our own psyche. Powerful nations tend to become very, very arrogant. They convince themselves that they are superior to others, and that arrogant superiority always leads to contempt for people of other religions, of other faiths, of other cultures, and it becomes incredibly destructive, both to those who hold power and those who are on the receiving end of power. I think genuine religion teaches real humility. The Jews have made a big deal of the fact that the covenant to Abraham says, I'm choosing you, you shall be my people, I will be your God. But it says also, I'm choosing you so that through you all the families on earth may be blessed. Well, we Americans consider ourselves God's chosen people, and this has led to arrogance and conceit. Muslims consider themselves God's chosen people, and therefore anyone who disagrees with them is God's enemy and should be killed. That's a minority of Muslims and a minority of Christians and a minority of Jews, but there's always that pitfall. It's very comforting to think we are God's chosen people, but we always forget why we are chosen. I think the call of God, properly understood by Jews and Christians and Muslims, the call of God is a call not to superiority, but a call to service. So, yeah, arrogance and self-righteousness are incredibly destructive, and we in the United States have gotten caught up in that all too often.
When the American Constitution was finally ratified by the various states, colonies, there was a celebration in Philadelphia in 1788, and John Meacham, in his book, American Gospel, points out that the clergy, defined most broadly, religious leaders, we would say today, had an active part in that celebration. But it was interesting in Meacham's description of what actually happened. Apparently, there were 17 in all. They included a rabbi and then various Christian ministers, priests, Catholic priests, Episcopal priests, Lutheran, Reformed, Presbyterian, Baptist pastors, 17 in all, marched in a procession in pairs.
In New York City.
Was it New York rather than Philadelphia? Sorry about that.
I think it was New York. You're
the historian. Yeah. Okay.
I think it was New York City.
All right. At any rate,
that's where the capital was.
Apparently they were put in pairs, and they were consciously put in pairs so that the most dissimilar would be together. There'd be a Quaker with a Catholic, and there was it specifically said that the Jewish rabbi walked arm in arm with two Protestant ministers. I find that image very, very encouraging.
Yes. And in the U.S. military today, we have Protestant chaplains and Catholic chaplains and Jewish chaplains and Muslim chaplains, and they are to minister to the needs of all of the troops.
But somehow for this to be happening in 1788, when the celebration of the ratification of the Constitution, I was surprised by that.
Yeah. So maybe there's hope.
Tell us about some of the difficulties that have happened historically. For example, with the Civil War, you mentioned the problem with slavery. Why with so many religious folks so early on in this country, we know that Jefferson was a slave owner, that many of the people who talk so much about freedom and liberty saw apparently no contradiction in holding African slaves themselves.
Well, they felt it was justified by the Bible, and almost every culture in world history has had slaves, so it was not at all unusual. But religion, all too often, by all of us, including me, I'm afraid, religion is used to justify what we want to believe. So the Southern states used biblical passages to justify slavery, and abolitionists in the North used the same scriptures to condemn slavery. And I found it very interesting the way this played out during the Civil Rights Movement. The black Muslim leader, Elijah Muhammad, the founder, taught his followers that they should reject their family names because their family names were just the names of their former slave owners, which was not quite true historically. But he also taught blacks to reject Christianity because it was Christians who had enslaved the blacks. But again, if you look at it historically, it's a bit more complicated than that. If you look at the slave trade somewhat objectively, black tribes within Africa had been enslaving each other for centuries before any whites appeared on the scene. And during the height of the transatlantic slave trade, black tribes in Africa would raid neighboring tribes, take captives, sell them to Muslim slave traders, who then transported them to the coast and sold them to white European slave traders. So, who's at fault? Actually, in contradiction to Elijah Muhammad, it was the British Parliament, acting out of Christian principles, that outlawed slavery in the British Empire and then outlawed the slave trade and used the power of the Royal British Navy to end the transatlantic slave trade. It was done by Christians on Christian principles. So who's really at fault for slavery and the slave trade? Well, if you look at Africa today, Muslims still practice slavery in Africa. So should we blame it on Christians? But yeah, this is one reason we have such a variety of religions. We decide what we want to believe, and then we use Scripture to support what we already believe. And one of the things that's bothering me about the Christian right today is that they're rewriting American history and they're rewriting the science books to conform with their ideology. And that disturbs me because, historically, the Stalinists in Russia rewrote the science books to conform with ideology. They rewrote history to conform with their ideology. The Nazis in Germany rewrote all the science books and rewrote all the history books to conform to their ideology. I find it very dangerous when people set out to rewrite history and rewrite science to conform with a preconceived ideology. This is not the way to approach history or science. I think we should look at the facts and then try to see what those facts say rather than impose our ideology. So this is why I think John Meacham's book is important. He has done his work as a researcher and as an historian, and he's saying, let's look at what actually happened and see what the evidence indicates to us. And the evidence is this was not crowned. The United States was not founded as a Christian nation. It was founded to be free of any established religion and to be a nation where all people of all faiths could exercise their faith in freedom.
Let me read another sentence from John Meacham's book, American Gospel, that sort of restates his thesis. The religious right's contention that we are a Christian nation that has fallen from pure origins and can achieve redemption by some kind of return to Christian values is based on wishful thinking, not convincing historical argument. When Meacham gives his various examples for this, he really makes two central points that I think are important. One is the one we've been making on this program, and you've stated very well that's sort of bad history to see America as a Christian nation at its founding. But he also points out that there's this sort of public theism or public the importance of that the founders seem to have in some kind of belief in a God. It wasn't unanimous. They didn't all agree with that, but it certainly carried the day. Meacham says that that's a difficult balance to maintain.
Incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is the Christian right remembers a day when the Christian churches in America set the tone, the moral tone for our whole society, because America was predominantly white Protestant. Well, the white Protestant church has lost that ability to determine the moral character of our society. And they're striving mightily to regain that control because they see us morally self-destructing. I think one interesting fact about the 9/11 hijackers was that they saw American popular culture as the greatest threat to traditional religion or traditional morality. American popular culture is the greatest threat. But conservatives in America agree. American popular culture is the greatest threat to morality because our popular culture is so immoral. This is why the Christian right is trying to convert us all to Christianity so that we can be a moral nation and not self-destruct. Well, who sets the moral tone? It's an important question. Right now, it is profit-making organizations that set the moral tone pretty much, isn't it? Or is it? Who does? Who determines what's moral and what isn't? Who determines the standards for what you can say on the radio and what you can't? Or who sets the standards for what can appear on TV and what can't? All of that's up for grabs. And many people, including devout Christians, are legitimately concerned about the moral tone of our whole society. But then the question is, what do we do about it? Moral people should have a say in setting the agenda, correct? But what is the proper way to try to influence the moral standards of our whole culture while maintaining freedom? It's an incredibly difficult balance to achieve and to maintain. It's a constant, constant struggle.
When there's a mention of morality, many people automatically think of sexual morality and remember that Thomas Jefferson apparently fathered a child illegitimately with one of his slaves, female slaves. Benjamin Franklin was notorious as I suppose today we'd say a womanizer. And yet these people from our early founding times made a great statement about the importance of morality. And yet it was, they were participating in exterminating Native Americans.
They were holding slaves?
Yeah.
even people in the North.
Why are there these big gaps in our self-awareness?
Because we're human. And part of the problem is that we have tried to deify our founding fathers rather than seeing them as the flawed human beings that they were. All of our political leaders are flawed. All of our religious leaders are flawed because every human being is deeply flawed. That's just the fact of life.
We have 6 or 7 minutes left. We can slip in another couple phone calls. 333-9455 is the local number in Champaign-Urbana. 1-800-222-9455. For those for whom it would be a long-distance call, we have another caller on line number one. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just have two suggestions, and I'd like to get your guest's reaction. One, in terms of what is needed today, the first, I would say, might be more history, and the second might be more philosophy and law. And I'll just explain quickly, and I'll try to make it very brief. By more history, your guest, for example, just said something that, is religion, Christianity responsible for slavery, and then went on to cite various examples without really looking at the history of slavery and using African Islamic slavery to counter the Christian sort of slavery in the United States. And one difference between them is that only in the United States and the Caribbean was slavery something that you could inherit. It was passed on genetically. And secondly, about the philosophy and law, instead of thinking of one of ourselves involved in this terrible moral wilderness that we can't get a hold of, both philosophy and law, I think, have ways of trying to get us out of that. But if the United States would pay attention to the kind of moral, legal, international treaties about the rights of the child, and the Genocide Convention and these kinds of things, there is a strong basis for even a universal morality that we need to really grasp. And I'll just get offline and listen. Thank you.
Appreciate the comments. Thank you very much.
Very thoughtful. First of all, the Southerners in the United States who used the scripture to justify slavery ignored what you just said. The rules about slavery in the Old Testament are that no one can be enslaved for more than 7 years. And slavery was not passed on to that person's children. So slavery in the United States was vastly different from slavery in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, it was for no more than 7 years, and the children of the slaves were not slaves. They were Hebrews. So, yeah, that's a very important point. When you're talking about law as being part of the answer, what immediately came to mind was, if you look at public opinion polls, lawyers rate lower than used car salesmen when it comes to ethics and morality. What does that say about studying law and its connection to morality?
When we look at Meacham's book, American Gospel, he talks about the problems over time with the way the Constitution was looked at. And in that very early legal document, it soon seemed to have almost have a sacred character. It's interesting that it became almost like scripture. And sometimes even today we feel that, but it is amendable. It's changeable. It's not like the Quran, which is settled, or the Bible, which is has a canon. It can be amended. How does a historian look at that process?
Well, I won't speak for historians, but I'll speak for myself, okay? Yes, we have deified our founding fathers, and we have deified the Constitution. We've put it right up there with Holy Scripture. This whole movement towards strict constructionism means get back to the original intentions of the founding fathers. Well, I'm sorry, we don't live in 1790. We live in 2007. The world has changed. We cannot strictly interpret and apply the Constitution the same way as we did in 1790. It needs to be a living document. There are times when it needs to be amended. But the amendment process was intentionally made difficult, and I think that is as it should be. We should not lightly amend the U.S. Constitution, especially to write into it an ideology. So, our founding fathers were not gods. They were flawed human beings. The U.S. Constitution was a series of compromises. It is a flawed document. It has served us well, but it is not perfect, and it never will be, because it's written by human beings and interpreted by human beings. Let's not make it an absolute, because I don't think any human being ever has the absolute truth, and circumstances change.
Interestingly, although the Constitution has no direct mention of deity, of God, the Declaration of Independence does.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
The writers of the Constitution, again, I think, consciously chose not to refer to God to avoid religious conflicts. They founded a civil government. And I think John Meacham, in this book we're talking about, American Gospel, makes that very clear. This is, our Constitution is a civil document setting up a civil society, and mentioning God or religion was considered inappropriate.
I want to thank our guest, Bill Kegel, who is a professor of history and religion at Millikan University in Decatur, for being our guest today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. I'm the director of the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. The Y is the oldest religious organization at the universities, founded in 1873. And over the past 134 years, the Y has grown to be open to people of all religious faiths and traditions or none. We involve many students and faculty and staff in service projects, educational experiences, forums, and community service and social action. If you have questions about the Y, do call me at 337-1500 in area code 217. Next week on Keeping the Faith, my guest will be Father Greg Ketchum from the Newman Foundation at the University of Illinois. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
It's been called divine, and it's been called disgusting. That's arguably one of the most important books of all time. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, as we ask the question, what makes a modern classic? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Only a few laps to go, and the WILL car is coming in to refuel. Look at that. A pit crew of thousands is contributing toward that $2.1 million goal. Already the fuel gauge shows their tank is 73% full. Help power the programs you value. Call 217-244-9455 or visit willpledge.org. Thank you.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with scattered thunderstorms in the evening, then a slight chance after midnight. The low in the lower 60s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high in the lower 80s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with the low in the lower 60s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour.